Hey, how are you? Welcome to the landmark 300th episode of the Entrepreneur Experiment podcast with me, Gary Fox. To be honest, reaching 300 is phenomenal. I still can't get my head quite around it, but I'm very proud to have reached that landmark. When I started back on the boat 4 years ago, I started on a little fold-down table. I had a Blue Yeti mic and no headphones, and I just hit record. I had no idea what I was doing. And I've to reach 300 episodes and to have built what I've built is it's something I'm really proud of. It's not something I speak about much. I am going to do a special episode about the podcast, how it started, what it's all about, and why I actually do it in probably the next coming couple of months. It'll be a deep dive kind of interview with myself. I'll get someone to do it so it's not weird. I'm not talking about myself in the third person. But today is a really important one. And it's a really beautiful moment for me because I was able to bring back four entrepreneurs who've been on the podcast and who've been a part of my journey, and I've been a small part of theirs. And what's even more special is that today I'm announcing a new role that I have. So I'm now a special advisor to the EIIS Innovation Fund, powered by Quintus Capital. So Kevin Canning and Brendan Moran, the people behind that, two fantastic businessmen that I've been lucky enough to get to know. And I'm now a special advisor to their fund, which is a huge achievement for me and a landmark in my career, and something I'm also very proud of. And they've actually also invested in these four entrepreneurs. So you can see why the partnership works. Already, there's deep connections there. Today, we're going to talk to Peggy Crowley, the founder of Ground, Niall Harty, the co-founder of AllReal, Matthew, the co-founder of Squid, and John Ryan, the founder of Gigable. You'll be familiar with these names if you're a long-time listener of the pod. And today, we find out a little refresher on how they started. And then mainly, we dig into how it's going, what's been happening, what the last couple of years been like, and then what the future holds. And some really innovative new financing models they've been exploring with Quintus and with the EIIS Innovation Fund. So here is episode 300, and I hope you enjoy it. I've been getting a lot of messages in the last couple of weeks from people saying they're really enjoying the pod. So if you are enjoying it, throw me a message. I'm pretty easy to find. First, quick thank you to my partners. Today's episode is presented in association with Square. Over 4 million companies, from local shops to international chains, use Square to take payments, manage staff, and do business in-store and online. For almost everything your business needs, visit square.com. Square International Limited, trading as Square, is regulated by the Central Bank of Ireland. I've got a massive ambition for this podcast. I want to make this the number one business podcast in the world. If I'm going to do that, I've got to be world-class on every single level. And that includes having a world-class studio, which I now have at iconic offices, The Green Room. It's an incredible space. I first recorded here with my live pod back in June, and I loved it. And get this, it's publicly bookable. That means you can go online and book it right now. As I said, it's called The Green Room. It's a private cinema and screening room. That means it's perfect to wow a client with a pitch, host a private screening, or do what I do, record a podcast here. So, as I record here, and as you know, I'm a member of Iconic Offices, I've got the team at Iconic Offices to hook us up with a number of exclusive complimentary office trials and discounts for my audience for booking this exact space. No catches. Simply go to the web link in the description, grab the offer that works best for you. Thanks, Iconic Offices. The Wealth Summit is on at the RDS on November 15th. It's for entrepreneurs, business owners, and those that aspire to be. If you're at the startup, scale-up, or sell-up stage of the entrepreneurial journey, then the Wealth Summit is for you. Learn how to build personal and business balance sheets through business growth strategies and build out critical paths to financial independence. Join Stephen Bartlett, Niall Quinn, Mandy Hickson, Tom Gannon, and 30 other speakers for a day of empowerment, motivation, education, growth, and networking. And we have an exclusive offer for listeners of the pod. For €150 plus VAT, you're going to get a discounted Access All Areas ticket, which also gives you access to the Wealth Tribe lunch, and it gives you a free masterclass on November 16th on how you can actually implement AI into your business. So click the link below to avail of this incredible offer. Okay, usually it's welcome to the pod, but welcome back to the pod.
Oh, thank you very much. Delighted to be, and lovely to meet you in person.
Yes, I forget like who I've met and who I haven't met in person. So it's beautiful.
World.
Yeah, it's phenomenal. Like I met a lot of you before and the middle and after of COVID. So we've kind of got three lifetimes to go through. So I think the easiest thing to do is just give us a quick overview of what Ground does, and then we'll kind of get a catch up. So just give us a quick overview of what Ground does and kind of just the origin story, how it started.
So Ground is a spa brand, and we work B2B with hospitality and very high-end hotels. And we started during lockdown, deep in lockdown, the May, once I knew the spas weren't opening up, and I would design spas and work with properties like Adair Manor, the Cliff House, and always would have designed concept treatments and massages along with private label products for these hotels. So not only was my consultancy closed, but also my private label supply. So I got brave, kind of everything just went quiet, and I tuned in, and I think we were very lucky. It's a saturated market, spa is, but it's been very focused on anti-aging and beautification and pampering and indulgence and almost exclusive to exclude. And I could see the opportunity to be more sincere by way of sleep, menopause, cancer care, children with diverse learning, and really to bring well-being to land it, to ground it, basically, in the real world, and price it accessibly and be exclusive, not only for people who are pregnant, but people who are going through fertility treatment, and just kind of working it that way. So it's taken off organically. We've grown amazingly. I'm just back in from London. We've launched with the Lanesborough. We're working with the Bulgari in Rome, the Kempinski Group.
You kind of ruined my first question. I was going to say, you're growing like a rocket. Give us the inside scoop.
Yeah.
But you are everywhere. Every morning I go into the gym and you're on the wall. Like there's a whole wall of Ground products. Like you are absolutely everywhere.
We're lucky. Do you know what? We've grown organically. We've never knocked on a door. And the difference is it was needed and people didn't realize it was needed. And menopause is openly spoken about. Now, EI put me in touch with Japan and we did a Zoom where I was asked not to speak about it because it's private. So it's culturally, it's different. And cancer care as well. They don't want to speak about that. So it's an interesting space, but certainly where we live on this side of the world, this equity in sleep, it sells at a ratio of about 4-1 across other products. And men are coming to the spas where before they would have come in and said, I need a deep tissue. I'm an athlete. I've been playing golf. And now they come in and they say they're burnt out. They're working from home. They're anxious. And it's opened up. It's been a wonderful time for well-being for people to open up into it. So it's,
why has that happened?
Lockdown. I think we met ourselves. I met myself. I had been developing spaces and spas and training therapists and showing people how to surrender for 25 years. And I couldn't settle myself in COVID. I'd gone into an early menopause, which doubled things up. My husband had a barrel of a time with me. But basically, I had to meet myself during that time. And that's why I said this is needed. And we started off being self-care at home. We partnered up with Brown Thomas. We sold out 3 times in 6 months. We were making it all from home. My mother was in our bubble. She was the head of bath salts. The daughters were meant to be homeschooled. They were head of boxing. And we had a ball of a time. And we then rented the house across the road. So that was like a meth lab, a 3-story house. And we belted out about $250,000 out of that house. And then we grew up, put our big girl's knickers on, and we started paying business rates and insurance. And we took an actual unit. And our biggest milestone is Aidan joining us this month as a head of operations, because literally for the last 2.5 years, I've been buying every ounce of lavender, getting on a plane to every account in the US. And now there's someone just to head it up. So it's like taking Valium. Yeah, I'm all for it.
You're one of those episodes that when I do it, I'm kind of in the moment. And then afterwards, I'm like, wait, what did she say about the growth? What did she say about how she started? Because It is a phenomenal story. Like it is unusual to find a fit and find it land so hard, so fast. I know you said it was a timing thing with COVID and everything, but even that itself, starting a business during COVID and then growing it, it's very rare.
Yeah, the timing was very important. My network, spa is a new industry. I'd be the grandmother of spa in Ireland. So we've set up the Irish Spa Association. I'd be very well connected through that. I would have great follow through. I love my partnerships and relationships and work, whatever I've been doing over the years. So I've worked with journalists. So when we launched our private label with Adair Manor, I'm behind the curtains telling them the story, but they can't mention me. So when I brought my own brand forward, the amount of press and support and Instagram, the kindness comes full circle. But I had definitely I'd laid the foundations without knowing it. I'd never thought I'd get this brave to do this. And it's the greatest journey I've ever, it's the most privileged space I've ever been in my life. And I'm so glad I took the plunge.
So bring us up to date in terms of, you know, a post-COVID world, I guess we're living in now. What's changed for you? I guess you started in COVID, so it's kind of unusual. I mean, have you noticed a change since the world has gone, like inverted commas, back to normal?
I think we all slowed down and enjoyed the slowing and promised ourselves we'd never jump on that hamster wheel at the speed we had been at. And I went back at 150%, and I'm sure other people did, because we were working from a place of not wanting to miss out and say yes to everything. The world, it just changed so much, not knowing when your income is gone just like that. And I could see trips to India and projects just falling out of my calendar. I was saying it to Aidan earlier, it was such a relief. I don't think I was a good mother beforehand. I think I was tough, but I was having a ball at the same time. Like it was an ego trip. I think I learned how to put my ego away and really connect with what's needed. And that served me. And I'm a much better mom, possibly wife, I don't know. But basically, it grounded me. It is. And I needed it. But even now, when you lose your business like that, and you begin a new business, you're operating from a place of scarcity, where your cash flow and your rent and your team, and you're managing it. And I have an excellent solicitor, Kieran Regan, and we had a massive Christmas. We'd been on the Late Late Show and won a prize, and we just cleaned up over Christmas, and we were really pleased with ourselves. And Kieran just said to me, "Do me a favor while you've money in the bank right now. Meet Kevin Canning, because you can't put yourself in that uncomfortable no oxygen zone again." And no sooner did I meet Kevin, worked it all out. It's just put us in a place where we can future proof and plan, and not just be day to day. It kind of lifts you out of the maze and the trenches, and makes you think, right, where. And then he connected us with Cork BIC, so an Enterprise Ireland, connected us with Dan Murphy, who's a gift. He just turned the number, he pushes the numbers through a system, and out pops who your most profitable clients. And you're like, really? They shout the least, but they make us the most money. Why aren't we doing more of that? So the support, the camaraderie, the learning, the mentorship, it's a very shared journey. That's what I enjoy about it. It's meeting other people. So I've loved it.
Unbelievable. Matthew.
Sorry.
Anyone not familiar with yourself, give us the quick overview of what Squid is. I'm sure everyone in the audience is, but you know, we went in depth on your first episode, and it was a really, really popular one. I think it just the authenticity just resonated with people. So give us just a quick overview of how Squid started and what it is.
Yeah. So Squid is a digital loyalty platform. And what we do is we create custom loyalty programs for small businesses, and we aggregate them into one app for ease of engagement. So we started Squid, myself and Katie, straight out of college. So I think for us, the big thing has always just been the amount of learning, and that at each sort of stage of our journey, there's so many elements to business to learn, but at each stage, every element changes in what it is. So in terms of us kind of starting and where we are now, you know, it's kind of an ever evolving process. So it's kind of difficult sometimes, I think, to put a kind of a where are we, if you know what I mean? Because it just changes all the time. We are live now across 4 continents. So it's spreading, which is kind of cool. Going to these, seeing boxes with Squid tags being posted out to these places I've never been before is quite fun. It's quite rewarding, I suppose. But yeah, no, we're fundamentally, we just kind of got fascinated by this whole space, like retail and the amount of money flowing through it. There's about 30 trillion spent in retail every year. It's the most competitive industry in the world. Guidelines are you should spend about 10% of your turnover on marketing. So, you know, there's sort of 3 trillion there that's going through on different programs. And it's well known that loyalty is the most cost-effective way to increase revenue. 90% of businesses have a loyalty program, but they all suffer from poor engagement, with the exception of those really big brands in the market, your Starbucks, et cetera, those kind of things. So what we kind of thought was that we could go after this. We could just make it super simple to engage with loyalty programs. We could try and get more people to buy into a business's ethos, buy into what they're doing, sign up, just purchase more often, lose your customers less. And fundamentally as well, build a kind of an ecosystem of consumers and businesses and leverage that ecosystem to drive more and more engagement. So that's kind of what we're about, what we're trying to do as we kind of push on.
That's a big problem to tackle.
It is.
Where did you even start? Because I think when you explain it, it makes total sense. But then when you're coming straight out of college and you're like, yeah, we're going to tackle this massive global problem.
Well, it started with Katie, I suppose, coming up with the design of how it would all look. So we were thinking of kind of different mechanisms, just this idea of most people, when they go in and they get a loyalty card, they don't want them because they're so kind of clunky. So, you know, it's a, do you want a loyalty card? No, it's not that you don't want the benefit of the loyalty card. It's that you don't want the, give me a form and I'll write my thing out and then you'll give me something and then I'll go and lose it and all that kind of hassle. So that was the first thing we tried to go after. And Katie came up with this idea of what we now call one touch loyalty. So just a tap basically to do it all. But we funded Squid initially on Matt Grind's money. So we didn't have a lot of, stuff to be going with. So it started with the tag. Katie had this kind of water bottle in her kitchen and the cork on top of it was a kind of an initial thing that she was able to grab and flip over and put a little NFC sticker on. And then that kind of just became like, it was very much in the beginning, a holding kind of thing, but it, now there's, hundreds of them about the place. So it's kind of, it's become more of a core part of our brand is that tag. It started initially with that. And then we just learned more and more about platform and the power of platforms and the power of, kind of an ecosystem and what that can be leveraged to do. So, then we started focusing on, okay, we've got this way of engaging with loyalty now, but what's our entry point? And kind of back to the same problem of, very little money, very little, lots of learnings to come, etc. We decided we'd go after coffee. So coffee was, such an emerging trend, I think. I'd someone describe it as kind of the new wine for sort of our generation. So if people are, they love talking about coffee, what coffee. There's so many specialty coffee brands now coming out as well. It's an amazing kind of space. But weirdly, there's not a lot of tech companies in coffee. So that became a focus for us is we'll go after coffee as an entry point. Sort of in the same way, books to Amazon, colleges for Facebook. That this was our sort of in to build up numbers before we start expanding across other kind of verticals. So still, work in progress, I suppose.
But you went after two massive problems simultaneously. You were building out software and hardware.
Yeah. So the hardware, it's funny. People call it hardware. Like to us, it's still just a sticker and a piece of cork. So, it's not it, like they cost buttons there. You can get them manufactured anywhere kind of stuff. And we just have loads of them back in our office. We've got boxes and boxes of them. So as a hardware, that's probably glorifying it a bit more than what it is. But the software element was and still is, the main kind of fascination, I suppose, of just the endless kind of possibilities that there are once you build this ecosystem of retailers, consumers. There's kind of, a lot of marketing opportunities there. There's payment opportunities. We've had loads of other retail software companies approach us, food ordering, booking softwares, all this kind of stuff, basically looking to leverage our engagement rate to deliver their kind of, their services out to our consumer base. So
how have you educated the consumer? Because you walk into a coffee shop, it's a busy environment. Like you're looking at the signs, you're looking at this, you're looking at that. How did you educate people to go, okay, I've paid for my coffee. Well, now I need to tap this.
So the businesses that sign up to Squid are actually our main promoters. So a lot of what we've been working on is basically just explaining, to a business that, look, if you get more people signed up to your loyalty program, you're going to have them buying more often. you're going to lose fewer customers. So a lot of what we focus on with kind of our customer success is how we educate the businesses that this is a good idea. We've now just started a new kind of initiative where we're actually rewarding baristas to promote Squid. So in other words, every time they promote, they get a download basically that will effectively incentivize them with kind of gift cards and stuff. But that's the kind of the bare, you know, is we're kind of creating a network of businesses, and from each business, it's like a node in a network, you know, that we can grow the consumer base through. So that's, it's through the businesses is kind of the short answer, I suppose.
And the same question I asked Peggy, post COVID, you know, in the last kind of 12, 18 months or so, what's been the change for you, or has there been a change?
So again, to your point on that, it is such a big area. It's so competitive. So I think one of the hard parts for us is keeping up with all the trends. And, you know, in COVID, one of the good things for us was that coffee became very much a kind of a social outlet for people to go for a coffee and a walk or something. Again, that's, you know, great for us now that we were able to leverage that at the time. So we were locked up in Cork and Dublin, basically trying to work out how we can get people to go and use Squid. Now it's more open. So, you know, we have more possibilities, but we're very focused now on other verticals. So it's you know, our current focus is more so in Ireland now, moving across into different areas of business. And in other regions of the world, it's the same plan. It's sort of seeding these different areas across these different continents with what we did in Ireland. So, you know, go in with coffee as the entry point and then move across from there. So COVID has changed things, but the world is changing so much that, you know, it's one of many factors that we have to kind of look at, I suppose, all the time.
As a business, how do you approach that? How do you approach that? I guess you've grown into it. You've grown as a company into this rapid evolving world. How do you think about that as a business? Like, do you discuss it a lot? Do you have plans? How do you keep up with the pace of innovation?
I think we try and just simplify things. So focus on, you know, fewer elements as opposed to more elements. So we're very focused on our platform, growing our platform and coffee. So, you know, with coffee, about 80% of the businesses on Squid are coffee businesses, but it gives us a very simple kind of blueprint of when we're going into a new market, we go after coffee, focus on that and grow the platform. What we've kind of learned is that the bigger our platform gets, you know, the more leverage, I suppose, we have in terms of we're able to launch new products. We become more appealing as a partner to other companies. We have more data, we have more insights, etc. It's always kind of a position of power to grow the platform. So region by region, things like culture and regional trends, etc., are tricky to navigate. But we've, you know, looked at other sort of platform businesses, how they launched in different markets, and we're taking kind of trends of what they did to build up a local network there, and propagate the same kind of pattern from that initial point.
Perfect. I'll get you to pass the mic to John, actually.
Thank you.
John, I think you were actually one of the first 30 guests in the pod.
I was
going
to ask you the first question, Gary, actually. Yeah, when was our first, when was that pod?
I did your mentor moment there a couple of months ago, and I think it was episode maybe like 40.
Okay.
All right. We're on 300. This is episode 300 today. So we've gone a long way. Thank you very much. But I messaged you about this the other day, like, you know, to see the both things grow together. Like, you have been hard at it for 4 years. Bring us back again, for anyone not familiar with us, with Gigable, bring us back to what it is.
Yeah, I guess just to your first point for all the founders here, it's about being pretty relentless. I think so. Everybody has that, you know, in order to kind of cut the mustard in being a founder, you have to have a pretty relentless work ethic. And definitely, you know, through COVID and everything else that went on over the last couple of years, it's just been the shifting sands, you know, that you have to adapt to. But today, and even day one when I started Gigable back in 2018, it's been about bringing the gig economy to a wider audience. Like, the gig economy is growing massively. 50% of the US workforce are in the gig economy. It's just this huge part of what fuels the economy day to day. But really, a lot of it's controlled by a few major players. And that's how it's grown so much. And to be fair to those players, they've created a brilliant work dynamic that really suits a lot of people who want to take flexible work or who want to just take random shifts. They're single parents, or they've got another job, or they want to get into earning an extra income as a side hustle, which is a huge thing for young people. But it's not that accessible to smaller businesses, right? They don't even know what it is. And even medium-sized businesses, because it is largely controlled by bigger enterprise. So my idea, day one, and what we're still building today is a product, a marketplace that connects businesses with local freelance workers for shift work, essentially. But core to that has always been a strong kind of a value stream in what we do. So we're very big into genuine independence of workers, transparency on what you're going to be paid, what the shift time start and finish is. These kind of basic things that you would take as a matter of course are not always there in gig economy version 1.0. So we're trying to kind of drive the charge of gig economy 2.0 or whatever you want to call it into being a more transparent and fair version of what was a brilliant idea, but needs kind of a reboot in our opinion.
So are you separate from the big players or do you work with them or how does that work?
Yeah, we're pretty much separate to them. I mean, it doesn't mean that a delivery driver working on a shift with a local restaurant through Gigable isn't delivering an order from Deliveroo or Just Eat or Uber Eats or one of those guys. That can absolutely happen. And it's very cost effective for restaurants to have their own delivery drivers delivering food from their restaurant, even if it came through another ordering, third party ordering platform. So complementary, I would say, in most cases, but we pretty much operate with small to medium-sized businesses largely on one side and then local freelance workers on the other side of the marketplace.
So give us a crash course in Gigable. How does that actually work?
So essentially, the hard side of our marketplace, and I think you know Matthew's talking about marketplace dynamics as well, is definitely the business side. So raising awareness, education, getting businesses onto the platform and actually posting shifts or making their schedule available to local workers is the first step. So we onboard them into the marketplace. Those shifts then become available as opportunities to local gig workers, freelancers. Let's say it's a delivery driver for Friday night from 5 until 10 p.m. or something like that. Anybody who's local, who's on the platform, who's verified by us can apply to do that shift. Then the business can choose them to work. They do the gig. They get paid in the platform. They both rate each other after the gig. So we've got a two-sided rating system in there, which is quite unique as well. And then if the business likes them, they can add them to a team and future gigs that they apply to, they'll be automatically accepted into. So we're really just trying to streamline that whole super flexible end of work, which is the gig economy. It's like the ultimate form of flexible work and make it really, really easy for both sides to kind of get involved in.
So 2018, I always talk about entrepreneur years as dog years. So you've seen a lot. You're a veteran from 2018. What's it been like going through the last kind of couple of years for you, especially with staffing and workers? We're open, we're closed, we're this, we're that. You can do this, you can't do that. It must have been a logistical nightmare.
It was tough for sure. I mean, when you're building a product like ours, and I think like Squid Loyalties as well, it's not really like bringing a hard physical product to market and you sell it and people love it and you just scale from there, which has its own challenges as well. A lot of what makes products like ours, I think, and marketplace products really work is just persistent, you know, consistent product improvement, like being really relentless about your product, being really relentless about getting efficiency in the product to deal with problems like that, the ups and downs of availability of workers, the critical mass you need of workers in an area to match the requirements of the businesses you have on that platform as well. So using a mathematical mindset to solve these problems is fantastic. It sounds lovely, but it takes a lot of time, a lot of testing as well, and a lot of product build to do that. But certainly, like, we started in 2018, it was me, basically. I started this on my own in 2018, essentially had an idea, but was so lucky, met some really amazing people that are still in the company today. Early on, we had kind of a core founder team by early 2019, raised our first seed round end of 2019, Enterprise Ireland, kudos to Enterprise Ireland. They've been brilliant supporters of ours and also Delta Partners here in Dublin. Came in and we had our first seed round and then, of course, COVID hit. And so the plans kind of went out the window. We had good traction even without product. So we were selling what we do, spreadsheets and phone calls. Like, we were literally saying, how many drivers do you need? What days do you need them? Where do you need them? And we just called them and we were recruiting them through Gumtree. So like, it was
people call that AI now. Just say it's an AI platform.
It was literally like, and manually invoicing the parties afterwards and reconciling it for 5%. It was like ridiculous, but it was a brilliant go-to-market tester because we had more than we could handle. But we got to a point where we said, like in late 2019, we're not doing any more of this until the product's done. So it's like, this is like the limit. Okay, we're just not going to even bother trying to onboard more customers. And then that kind of got a bit messed up during COVID, where we had this massive tailwind of delivery driver requirements. Like, everything was delivery and everything else stopped. But it was also a headwind because people were sick. People didn't want to leave their homes. They didn't want to work. Businesses were just shutting down and taking free money. So like our second market was the UK, and businesses were better off staying closed over there than they were being open in many cases. So it was really tough to manage that and just kind of, you know, ride the different waves of the ups and downs, the lockdowns or whatever. But we came out the other side of it and we learned a lot, adapting to the new normal as it is now, which changes, it seems, every 6 months. But very proud of the marketplace we built during that period as well to kind of deal with those issues, you know.
So what is the world as we know it now in your eyes, like the gig economy? What is happening now, the gig economy? Has it stabilized back to pre-COVID levels, or is it a whole new model? Do you see new trends emerging?
I do. I do think it's here to stay. And I do think it's going to grow because the younger generation generally don't want the 9-to-5er. Okay. They don't want to take full-time employment, especially actually where we kind of tackle is in, we say, low to semi-skilled work. Okay. So there's a massive shortage of low to semi-skilled workers generally, especially in the West. And that's actually, in my view, it's more an issue of matching the availability of time efficiently of people who can do that work with the actual work that needs to be done at the business, rather than there being a lack of workers. Okay. So there's a reticence there for smaller businesses to actually get onto this adoption curve, and they just don't know. The awareness piece is something we're working on building as well. But certainly from freelancers doing marketing, you know, on the side, to side hustling, riding for Uber Eats or driving a taxi, it is a preferred way to earn an income nowadays. And as I said, the younger generation seem to be all in on flexibility. It's kind of a boring word at this stage, but it's actually, if you talk to any of our freelancers, which we do regularly, the number one important thing is just flexibility. Like, I can do tonight and I'll decide at lunchtime, you know. It's not, I'm going to even book a, you know, a week in advance. And we even say, just for the kind of freshness of opportunities on the platform to our businesses, don't post like 3-4 weeks of gigs in advance. Unless you really need to, like, they'll still be there, but like post them kind of week to week. And then they come in and people go, yeah, actually, I'll do that with Gary's Pizza or whatever tonight.
The stress levels, all the owners in the audience just feeling the tension 100%. Rising. Yeah. Every single entrepreneur and founder I talk to, staff is the number one thing. They keep either a lack of or inflexibility, or they just don't know how to create an environment that they can work in. I had someone on this morning who was talking about remote, hybrid, in office. He was fully in office. He was like, I would do 5 days if I could. Yeah. So what's your advice, I guess, to people who are trying to adjust to having these massive staff crises? Obviously, use Gigable as the advice, right? Yeah. But what's your broader advice to owners?
I think, well, it depends on what sector you're in, to be honest with you. Like, I'd love if there was one straight answer for that, but there isn't. You know, if you need a certain niche of high-skilled workers, I think you need to look abroad and you need to be open to using people that are fully remote. You know, like all of our dev team are fully remote and they have been more or less from day one. Like the hardcore devs or CTO is here, like the key leaders are here, our DevOps is here, but the developers are actually overseas because there's just a wealth of talent available globally. And, you know, there's kind of a harmonization happening there at that remote level where you can get the same quality anywhere. But also the prices are kind of harmonizing a bit as well. So you'll pay not the same, still a lot cheaper to use overseas workers, but there is a bit of a balancing happening there. So if you're at that kind of high skill level where it can be fully remote, you know, you need to be open-minded to that. When you're at the kind of low to semi-skilled zone, like where we kind of operate primarily now, you need to be flexible with how you approach your workforce, okay? So if you have 10 people who want to work 10 hours a week, which is very common, right? Don't try and force them to do 40-hour weeks because they'll just quit and they'll go somewhere else because there's jobs aplenty out there. So you probably will need a team of 10 or 20 that are on a more flexible basis, which is harder for you to schedule and whatever else. But that's just the way things are right now. And you need to kind of roll with that. I think I still see a lot of businesses who are just relentlessly trying to recruit and people quit after a couple of weeks and they're trying to force square pegs into round holes and say, guys, that's not the way the world works anymore. Like, using Gigable or not, you need to think about a flexible workforce and how do you actually structure your business around that? Because otherwise you're just going to have this pain all the time, you know?
It's a fascinating one because everyone I speak to is unsure.
Yeah.
We don't know really. We're kind of using the office, we're kind of not. Then some people are in some days and we don't want to mandate it. It's a phenomenal space. So I think for you, you're talking about tailwinds and headwinds. There has to be a massive tailwind. Sure. Is there an education problem though? Are you educating? Are you explaining all the time why it's important?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's an awareness issue. It's educating on a business by business level, but also leveraging social. I'm doing a lot of social myself these days personally to try and raise awareness, try and use our own business owners who have adopted our platform and absolutely love it. They love the flexibility of it. They've got a great team of workers and it's like it's they couldn't do without it. Getting that story out there for any founder of any business is really, really important. Like the case study is kind of like, oh God, another case study. But you actually want to get real personable, relatable business owners or whoever your customers are on camera, preferably telling the world about how this has like changed their life or changed their business or whatever. And if you can't get that, maybe you're not doing a good enough job for them yet. And if you can, fantastic. You should shout about that. But we love the space we're in. We are tackling a huge problem. Like there's a huge problem of matching worker availability, workers generally, especially younger workers, low semi-skilled workers into roles that require them. Okay. So that's not a problem that's going to go anywhere anytime soon. Tackling that is a combination of great product, the awareness piece, having good systems, having a good team. And I think kind of like, you know, marketplaces definitely, it is a kind of a J curve business, as they say, like you do have a trough of disillusionment that you have to work through and you just need to put up with that and continue to stick to product. And then eventually you will have your moment. You mightn't be the next Instagram or whatever you're doing where you have that breakout moment and suddenly you're acquiring 100 million users in a month or whatever. Not necessarily always going to be like that. So don't look at the outliers, but even small breakouts do happen here and there. Like we're breaking out on the freelancer, the worker side, like all the time. We don't do ads anymore. We need to set up waiting lists because we just have too many people who want what we have who are workers. We literally get 15, 20 applicants to do a kitchen porter gig on a Friday night. Whereas you talk to the restaurant, they're like, they couldn't pay somebody 20 euros an hour to do kitchen porter gigs 5 days a week. It's like, yes, because they don't want to do it 5 days a week. They're willing to do Friday night for you, cover a shift. And that's tough because you need to go business to business and actually, you know, get that message out there. But it will happen. It's just a matter of when, it's not if, in my view.
That's a really interesting trend. Yeah. I'll dig into that a little bit more with you in a while. I'll just get you to pass the mic to Niall. You can just loop it around in front of you there, Matthew, actually. Oh, there we go. Perfect.
Yeah.
I was.
Niall.
Gary.
Your product starts my day every day.
Well, that's what I like to hear. I just need a lot more of you.
I am a weird creature of habit. I have the same thing for breakfast every day, porridge with all real butter on top of it.
Brilliant.
It is a phenomenal product. It's special. Like there's something special about what you're building. Tell us, you know, again, same question to you. How did it start? What is it?
So All Real Nutrition, we're like a sustainable nutrition brand. So we make real food protein bars that are wrapped in plastic-free packaging. And, you know, we donate from every sale that gives back to Stopping Ocean Plastic. That's kind of a small part of the business. But so we sell protein bars, like I said, online and in retail, predominantly in Ireland, but we've also launched in the US over the last 12 months. The business started really... I saw a big growth for protein as a general requirement for, you know, everyday people, as well as the growth of natural foods, and looked at them together and said, right, you know, there's a real market here for a natural protein rich bar. Literally started by myself in my home kitchen, making bars, going out to the local farmers market and just trying them out, seeing will people pay me money for this thing that I'm making, and just kind of built it up from there. You know, thousands and thousands of different recipe innovations and so on. Eventually started a brand previously called Origin, got that listed all throughout Ireland, but I always knew there was kind of a bit more there and I wanted to bring on a co-founder in the business to, you know, bring it to the next level. I know I really got the marketing, the consumer, how to create the product, but you know, what I was really falling back on behind at the time was the knowledge of retail and finance. And I really need to bring that skill set on. So I met my co-founder, Ross. He had a previous Biltong brand and had built that up in Ireland and across the UK in food service and so on, and built it up, sold it on, had a nice exit. So I was like, right, he's the guy I really want to bring in, you know. And we kind of came together and said, my previous brand, we had a really good product, but we felt there was so much more we could do with the proposition for the consumer. You know, we could see, like, personally, our own values, you know, we want to build a business that delivers profit, but also has a bit of a purpose behind it and gives back. So, you know, we really put a lot of thought into how we create a brand that really resonates with the consumer. And looks good on shelf, delivers on taste, delivers on nutrition, what was actually wrong in the marketplace and how we could fix it. So we see like there's a lot of what we would call the artificial protein bars. They're absolutely everywhere. And we said, right, then there's the other sector, the, you know, the good for you natural products. But typically, if the nutrition is okay, they don't taste so good, or, you know, the nutrition is like full of sugar, but they're all natural ingredients, you know, that kind of thing. So we said, right, you know, we have a product that actually fits that. So, you know, our product is 20 grams of protein, 220 calories or less. So it matches the artificial bars in the market, but gives the customer that kind of guilt-free and good for you. So we call ourselves like a protein bar that's good for you and good for the planet. So we match that same indulgent taste that you see with some of the other brands. We do with simple natural ingredients. So all our products have 12 or less ingredients, where most of the competitors, you know, the everyday person will open up the back of a pack, and you need a science degree to understand what, you know, mannitol, polydextrose, you know, collagen hydroxylase. Like, nobody knows what that is unless you're in the industry, you know, whereas if you look at a back of an all real pack, everyone knows what almonds are. Everyone knows what dates are. So, you know, we spent a long time developing the recipe to deliver that. And, yeah, we launched in January 21. We literally had zero stores. COVID wiped out the previous business. It was a good time to restart and refresh. So, yeah, we just kind of built it up bit by bit. And that was around the time I kind of was on your podcast, probably a couple of months after that.
So bit by bit.
Yeah.
Explain that to me, because that's the sauce, right? Yeah. That's the secret bit. We're like, bit by bit, how did you build it bit by bit? Because when you go in, you touched on it there, you go into like the food aisle and you go to the health sector, it's bewildering, right? I would consider myself pretty savvy about what I put in my body, but you're looking at an entire aisle of health foods and protein bars now. So how did you like force yourself onto that shelf?
Well, like from day one, myself and Ross have a really big ambition for the brand. So we know, okay, we're going up against brands that probably have double the marketing budget of our current revenue, you know, but we kind of said, right, let's kind of reverse engineer this bit by bit. Okay, we've a really good product. Let's get onto one shelf. Let's see what we can do, perform really well in one store. Then let's go to the next store and the next store and the next store. And then before you know it, you're 50 stores, 100 stores, and you've got a lot of data, and then you're going to the next retailer.
Are you physically, when you say going from, are you physically going from store to store? How does that actually happen?
Yeah, so like when we first launched, BWG was our first big account. So that's Spar, Mace, Londis, XL, those kind of stores. And, you know, we have a factory, we produce everything ourselves in Farm 4, County Kerry. You know, all our staff are super brand advocates as well. So we worked like overtime hours, built up stock, trained everyone up on how to sell the product. And we just got everybody out because, you know, like there's no better person to sell your own product like your own team. So we sent one.
That's an important thing, because I re-released this a few weeks ago, and because the amount of people that had fed that back to me going, yeah, they just got everyone out selling.
Yeah.
Everyone.
But also at the time, right, everyone thought the product was amazing, but we didn't have the data and the proof of concept behind us to get the likes of the partners that we have now to take us seriously. So we just had to roll up our sleeves and get it done. So we sent one guy up to Galway with a whole load of bars, and he was just going around in a bike, calling in store to store. And, you know, we had our little WhatsApp group. It's like, yeah, I got a store here, I got a store there. Ross was down in Cork. I was in Limerick. Someone else was in Dublin. And we just hammered as many stores as we could possible. And we realized, okay, we probably need to get a van on the road now to keep all these going. And we built it up. Then it was two vans, three vans, five vans. And then, you know, that BWG story got really good. Then we got into Tesco's. Then we got into Musgrave's, which is Supervalue and Centra, and just built up more and more and more stores. At the same time, pushing our e-commerce as well. You know, that's been really, it's, you know, probably a quarter of our business, but, you know, it's a substantial part. It really delivers to like our brand advocates and people who really love All Real. And also the advertising we do to convert to sales helps for brand awareness for people when they see it in the store. Oh, I saw someone talking about that online. I'll pick that product up.
Like, to build a brand like that and to do all that you've talked about there in the last couple of years, it sounds immensely challenging. When I look at food businesses, I'm like, oh, you need a strong stomach for that. Like, what's been the biggest challenge over the last kind of 3 years? Like, you've outlined a good few there, but what's been the biggest one?
So it's the biggest one we've kind of overcome in the last couple of months, or last 12 months really, is, you know, we start off doing absolutely everything ourselves. But there's a certain point where, you know, you can't be day to day in a factory managing all your sales reps, doing everything. And there's a certain point where you start need to bring in key management into the business and just kind of let them do what they do best and let us do what we do best, which is push the brand forward, focus on the sales and the marketing and so on. Actually, part of our fundraise with Quintus last year helped us to bring in really key managers into the business, and kind of like we're really reaping the benefits of that now going forward.
Well, bring me through that process. Like, when did you know, okay, we need to bring in experience and we need to bring in financing?
When I started going grey, doing 100 hours a week.
Yeah. I noticed you shaved the sides. That's a good idea, actually, because that's where I'm going grey. I'm going to do that.
Yeah. Very good. It got to a certain point where, you know, we had a huge spurt of growth and then things were slowing down and it felt like we were just getting product on shelves and keeping the business running as opposed to growing the business. And we thought, okay, now we need to get people in. So now we've got like a senior ops person in from the Kerry Group. We've got a senior accountant in who was full-time, actually half her business is Kerry Group now at this stage, from Kerry Group, worked with Marks and Spencer's, worked with another food startup in London. We got more kind of, we formalized the board of the company to strategically put us the right way. We brought a really good advisor in the US as an advisor to our board for strategy there. You know, she's part of Cliff Bar. I don't know if you know them, but they're the biggest acquisition in our space recently. They're sold to Mondelez for $2.9 billion. She's been with them since the early noughties and is a sales director with them. So the value that we have there has been absolutely amazing. And now since then, we're really kind of gearing up our business now for the next stage of growth because like we're outperforming in category and it's just to do that more is kind of the next stage. So we've been really building out more stores in Ireland, getting Ireland right. And it's basically...
What is more? What's the target? What's the dream?
Well, we've a fairly kind of audacious revenue goal that we see. But, you know, first, we want to get Ireland absolutely right. Be one of the main protein brands in Ireland. Now we're working on it. You know, we're almost there. We do a lot of kind of research and consumer studies. And, you know, sometimes you'll come back and go, oh God, only 20% of people knew All Real. Other times, 80% of people knew All Real. So we know we've a lot more work to do there. But, you know, Ireland is a fantastic market and, you know, you have to get it right, but you're not going to build a multi-million company here in Ireland. I mean, you can, but from a consumer brand point of view, you know, when you've got a product that fits really well, that's, you know, export ready, that's really where we're focused. So, you know, the big opportunity for us right now is the United States. We got a listing there that went live 12 months ago in a company called Sprouts Farmers Market, our premium natural foods retailer. Absolutely amazing store. There are about 400 stores across the country. So we kind of were on a board BIA program, an accelerator program. And at the end, we got to pitch our business to a panel of retailers just to get feedback on how it would fit in the market. We had no real intention of trying to get a listing. And then the buyer who was just taking on the category, he's got Irish roots. His name is Sean Lyons. He was like, you know, my family are from Cork. Oh, I'd love to see you guys come on here. I think they're from Blarney, you know, this kind of thing. So we said, look, okay, like we really thought about it. Is this too soon? Is it not too soon? Is it going to overstretch us? He said, look, let's just focus on getting one account right and doing it really, really well. And that's what we've done over the last 12 months. So, you know, our rate of sale is doing really, really good over there. We've doing lots of promotions in store and so on. And the data is coming back that, you know, All Real is performing really well. We're in the top 40 brands nationally in the United States in the natural category, just with that one listing. So we know that there's a lot more over there. But before we go crazy over there, we're getting that right. We're getting lots more kind of premium small listings before we go into mainstream. We need to get one or two more listings in Ireland, get that right, set up more of a team, and then myself and Ross are stateside and going for the big goal.
I love the ambition.
Yeah.
I love it. I can feel the energy. I know you worked with Quintus for the financing. What's the hardest unlock as a young business in terms of like getting the financing right and kind of managing your money?
My goodness, it's chicken and egg from day one, you know? Like everyone wants to back a success. We can't be a success without funds. And, you know that is kind of a challenge. But again, what are the key things? In our space, it's gross margin. You know, it's becoming cash flow generative. You know, a couple of years ago, we see businesses in a product space and they're just raising silly money. Investors didn't really care about well, obviously they care about profitability, but they just want to growth. Let's flip it and make money. Whereas now we're kind of seeing, you know, and it just makes more business sense to be focused on gross margin, having a business that's actually a business and making money.
Profit, weird.
Yeah. It's weird, isn't it? Yeah, but that's NGA, and that's a massive focus for now. So that, you know, we're building a strong foundation to our business so that we can grow and self-fund to a certain point. And if we need to go for audacious growth and raise big capital, we can do that if we want, but you know, that we're kind of fairly solid.
Perfect. John, same question to yourself. How do you think about financing as a startup founder? Like, how have you managed from like 2018 to 2023? Like, what's been your journey?
Yeah, I mean, it's changed a lot as well, because during COVID, you know, there was a lot of free money around, so to speak. So it was easier to raise money. People were reaching out, especially kind of, say, Series B plus. We're doing massive unicorn rounds. Those are not going to happen again for a while. There's going to be a lot of down rounds, cram downs, all this kind of stuff happening over the next 5 years. So the whole marketplace has completely changed over the last 4 years in terms of raising funding. And I do think, just to echo what Niall said there, that, you know, they're obviously gross margin focused because they're producing a product or whatever. When you're in software space, like, the expectation now is when you're at Series A, B or whatever going forward, that you're basically at break even or profitability almost. Whereas previously that wasn't even a consideration, right? So if you are going out to raise finance next year, normally these cycles, like 2000 crash in that rate, you know, venture crash, the tech crash, it's about 5 years before valuations came back post 2000, right? So we're in year two of it, we'll say now. So any Series B, C of companies that have raised big money at big valuations are going to have to rebalance that probably over the next couple of years. But the smaller stage companies that are fairly valued, that are kind of like seed Series A, which is like where we're at, you know, there's still a lot, like I get a lot of even private equity reaching out now, which is unusual for smaller companies to be, you know, targeted by private equity, because they want to get in early. They see that there's a massive problem that we're trying to solve in this low-skilled worker problem that we talked about and the availability there. But certainly from a founder's perspective now, my view is like, try to get to break even or run a lean organization, because that's just the way things are going forward for the next, you know, 3, 4, 5 years. So if you're raising your first round or follow-on rounds, have a path to getting to profitability and make that happen, and just make that a goal as well as growth. You want to grow, but I think efficient growth that shows a path to like a real business in a kind of a traditional sense is what investors are really looking for now. So kind of have that in your scope at the moment is really important.
What is kind of the roadmap for Gigable kind of the next 18, 24 months? Like, you seem extremely focused. So kind of give us an insight as to what that looks like.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, for we're in two markets at the moment. So it's Ireland and the UK. And part of what we want to do to really kind of 10x our growth across a couple of industries is to get further into kind of the service level of what we do. So by that, I mean, make it easier for bigger businesses to use our platform, essentially. So we built an excellent platform for small businesses, and we're pushing that out hard as we can. But really, we want to grow that in a way that, like, the beauty of software is there's like a zero marginal cost to scaling it anywhere, ideally, right? But when you've got a business that's a marketplace, there's also the people who use your marketplace. And you know, obviously, you've got your businesses on our platform, you've got your workers, and you need a way to be able to scale that in a new market that's as close to zero marginal cost as possible. So building a system, building a game plan of how you do that through marketing, promotionals, referrals, social activity, paid ads on Meta, whatever it is your stack is, cold emails or whatever. So we've been building a system for about a year now and testing it of how we do that in this market. And I agree with Niall as well, like, mind the knitting, as the old folks would say, get Ireland right, get that really, really good, have a good system here. We're also in the UK, use that same system in the UK. But for us, we're looking at North America next as well as a market. So an East Coast city in North America is on the agenda for us in 2024. We think the adoption curve, especially at the small business level, is much, much higher for what Gigable is in North America than it probably is in the UK and Ireland. So that's an assumption we're actually testing right now with some go-to-market planning as well. Using that same exact zero marginal cost system. You know, the beauty of that is you can kind of iterate that and get the cost even down from where it is today if you kind of keep planning and doing A-B tests and go, okay, that one worked a bit better, that one was cheaper, that ad campaign, that video worked better than that one. It's very hard to do that when you've got a high cost or even a high person-driven sales system. So our approach now is to be very, very mathematical about sales, really, which I think is a kind of realization a lot of startups land on if they can get away with it later on in the journey, is throwing people at the problem when you had loads of money, which is, you know, what all these big rounds were all about during COVID, was here's 50 million, like literally hire 100 salespeople and grow at X or whatever, right? We didn't raise that or whatever, thankfully. I'm really glad that didn't happen. But now, and ourselves included, we're very much focused on as close to zero marginal cost scaling system as possible, and then applying that into the US market in 2024.
Brilliant. Matthew, same question to you. Speaking of mathematical geniuses, how do you approach financing? How do you approach financing as a startup founder?
I mean, it goes back to, I think, like the massive learning curve, I suppose, that it's been. Initially, like, I do remember with myself and Katie, just with the numbers, being college graduates, we couldn't conceive how these big companies were spending millions, tens of millions, etc. So when we went out, the first raise we went out looking for was 25 grand to try and build this into a kind of a $1 billion business. And we thought that would be plenty. but then I suppose you learn more and you see kind of, okay, right, there's costs here, there's costs here, there's, you know, things that we need. And so I suppose one of the biggest learnings has been, you know, something that was kind of alluded to around that when you have capital, funnily enough, it's actually a good time to raise more capital. And that's been a big learning for us, I suppose, is that we would go from cycle to cycle before. So I think now, you know, we're completing our seed round now. But I think, you know, we're in quite a good position where we're doing the things already that we're supposed to be in order to move to our Series A kind of milestones. So I think it's putting us, you know, the fact that we have launched in so many markets, that we've got the partners who we wanted to build with, we've already started building with them. We've tested kind of the new marketing products that we wanted to release. They work, you know, that's always kind of a nice one to sort of go back on and go, thank God. But yeah, I think it's kind of a good time, I suppose, to leverage that fact and try and kind of look outside towards, you know, now again, the difference for us is probably more of a global fundraise. So we were initially very Irish focused. So, you know, we're delighted to be working with Irish investors. It's always been, I think, the network that we got here, the learnings, you know, the people in Ireland, I find, are so generous with their time, particularly. They're so willing to help you, you know, and it means a lot, obviously, to us to be able to leverage those kind of learnings. But I think we feel we're kind of coming more to a position now where we've got something that it works. We've got, you know, really big partners now who are building with us. And yeah, we kind of want to turbocharge it, I suppose. So in terms of the next fundraise, you know, we have some Sequoia scouts involved in the business who can help us in terms of kind of, you know, US reach. But we also want to look a lot at the UK and other markets that we're live in. So I think for us, you know, the fundraising, yeah, it's definitely been, so saying, like, just an eternal learning curve. But yeah, the next part, I think, will probably be more of a global, you know, international investors, I suppose, coming in.
Whoever went in at 25 grand is going to be a very, very happy person. What's the next 18 months look like for Squid?
So it's a huge amount of product development is the short answer. So we're building a lot of product that brings us into new verticals. So we've started working with some really big partners that we'll be announcing soon enough. But yeah, it's a lot of, as I was saying, kind of that we've got this product built. We've kind of built the beta versions of a lot of stuff. Again, I know it sounds kind of an obvious point, but you have no idea how exciting to see that it works, you know, and to be able to leverage that across these new areas that we've kind of seeded. So we're focusing on the UK in particular. We've got a lot of people over there working on just expanding the Squid platform in the UK. We've also launched in new regions across the globe. So we'll be focused on pushing on that similar plan of get after coffee, start a kind of a consumer base there. But now, as I was saying, what we will have is this ability to move across verticals, which we're very excited about, and the ability to leverage the kind of the insights and the engagement that we have to help businesses and consumers kind of interact in a more seamless fashion, build better relationships between consumers and businesses. And yeah, I suppose, again, it's just focused on maintaining our engagement rate, but growing in other verticals and delivering that product to market.
I love the logic and the rigor you apply to growing and building your business. Peggy, same question to you. How do you approach financing as a founder?
So this is my weakest area that I have. I'm kind of ostrich that way. But the last year, so we turn 3 in November next month, the end of next month. And we've bootstrapped. We literally bootstrapped until the middle of September just gone. And there was a moment where $500,000 landed in our bank account, and we are normally in, we've an overdraft of 20 grand and we're normally at minus 18, minus 19. And I'm like, and then the rent comes in and then I'm over the edge. But the money landed, and I remember my husband saying, oh my God, what are we going to do? We're going to celebrate. I actually had to go to bed. I was so overwhelmed when I saw the number. I just said, Jesus Christ. And I took to the bed, and that was fine. And then, and we're compared to you guys, I think we're in nursery school. We're very much, we're so involved in the product because we manufacture everything from scratch. So we're buying in all our raw materials, all our componentry, and we're really proud of being artisan. But the hiring of Aidan is going to bring such efficiencies to our business, and we have to spend money to buy in equipment and manage our stock holding. And, you know, up until this point, I'm ashamed to say our B2B Xero platform hadn't interfaced with our Shopify platform. And I never kept an inventory. This is like confession. I never kept it. We just survived every day. We'd order in the product. We'd make it. Cash flow was tight. You'd protect the team and you just kept going. So when my sister said, we got to get you organized for your next round, the brand is taking off. We need to believe in it more and just get the funding in so you're never at that stage again. And I just think, you know, there was a very proud moment. I was on the PUP at 350. So as soon as I could pay myself, I paid myself 350. And last month I went up to 40 grand a year. So I'm kind of pleased with myself. So when you ask about finances, I will take great advice from Kevin. I trust him with my life. He'll come in. Dan Murphy from BIC. I've great advisors. Aidan is going to be enormous help with our distributors.
Jeez, the pressure on Aidan. I'm nearly sweating for him as well. As you're saying, like it's ratcheting up.
Listen, I'm very fortunate, and it's just I want to work where I'm strong. I'm much more comfortable in a creative space, in a sales space, and I just need all of that side of the house managed, and it'll be a huge relief. So financing. Enterprise Ireland are entering the building at 300k. So $500,000 landed in from Quintus. 300k is being lined up before Christmas, hopefully. And after that, Kieran said we go and we look for something else.
It's phenomenal to see where you've gone. I had forgotten it was nearly coming up on 3 years. Like, it's phenomenal to see what the brand looks like and the growth you've had in 3 years. It's breathtaking, to be honest. Can you process that? Are you too close to it, or can you process that?
No, you can't. There's moments of immense joy. Like, we were in the States maybe a year ago, and meeting with the Four Seasons Hotel Group, and they were like, oh yeah, no, we'll definitely take you on and we'll do this. And normally when you're working with Brown Thomas or the Shelburne or the K Club, we'll take 12 of this, 24 of this, we'll take, you know, and you're sitting with them in the States, we'll take 1,000 of that. And here's me going, oh my God, I'm afraid to tell the team at home they're going to be up all night making these oils. No, the volume, like I'm really excited for you guys with the States, but having that key woman who knows it's cutthroat over there as well. And it's, you know, working with distributors, you know, sometimes they're magpies, you're bright and shiny at the beginning and then they find other. So Aidan had a distribution himself, so, and worked with distributors. So it's again, it's brilliant to have that experience and that distributor agreement and the legality, all of that being managed with agreements as well as trademarking in certain territories, learning loads. It's not for the faint hearted, but I'm looking forward to being in my growing and learning, but doing what I love as well.
So what does that look like? What does the next 18 to 24 months look like?
So we're collaborating with different people to sit at the kind of edge of well-being and kind of future-proof it. So we're working with a plastic surgeon here in Dublin, Sean Murphy, working on lymphatic drainage and post-operative scar tissue release, that side of the house. We're also working on different, I suppose, products for cancer care. We do a lot of BAMs for different, like from radiation to chemotherapy. The skin is the excretory organ that removes the poison from our bodies when it's targeted with chemo. And we're learning an awful lot about hair loss and how to manage that. So it's just meeting people where they're at in their own health and well-being and being able to supplement it. So it's kind of the sky is the limit, but certainly lymphatic is big. We've just developed a cleansing oil for the gut, not to take internally, but externally, the lower back and the and castor oil detoxifies the liver, the kidneys, and you add in your antispasmodic essential oils like your fennel, your ginger, peppermint, and suddenly you're helping people with digestion and gut health, and then you tune into metabolic health. And when you combine lymphatics with abdominal treatments, you enter a space where you can take someone's lymphatic pulse and understand their metabolic rate and you know, enter into the blood sugar space and just to touch on everything. But we're our business, spas, our therapists, the people delivering in our industry are not now as educated as the end consumer coming in for a treatment. So our USP is our education, is advanced massage. And it's the reason why one spa manager or one hotel director rings another saying, you need these guys in. Our training is second to none. We have an excellent girl, Rachel O'Malley, who develops treatment and training. And a bit like you guys, getting that right, that's our actual product, is our training. It's IP. The products, while they're excellent, they're therapeutic grade essential oils, but aromatherapy oils are made by hundreds of people all day long. So our USP is our training and our massage. And it's humbling work, but it's so incredibly meaningful for people who, like post-COVID, when people hadn't been touched in so long and the loneliness, you'd be surprised how much massage and looking after yourself in the month when you're stressed. And it's become very big. Now it's expensive. It's elitist to a point. And certainly our partners, and we never set out that way, but it's our training, it's our massage training that's opened the doors for us.
Phenomenal. That is a wrap on episode 300. I want to thank Quintus EIS Innovation Fund for hosting us. I want to thank Peggy from Ground, Matthew from Squid, John from Giggle, and Niall from All Real. Please give them a round of applause. I hope you enjoyed episode 300. That was really fun. I really, really did that. It was live. We did it in Dublin. It was live to get everyone together in front of an audience. And it really was a special night. It really was one of those moments where I kind of stopped and enjoyed. Often you can be just driving forward a lot. And I really just paused after that night and just kind of looked around and was really proud of what we've done here. That's it for episode 300. I'll see you back here. Same bat channel, same time. Episode 301. It's coming in a couple of days. I'll see you then. Have an incredible week.